Welcome to this week's Some Other Scotland headline newscast with me, Mick Bourdais. In Scotland's news this last week, lost artwork returns to pride of place. 40 years ago, artist Alistair Gray painted a mural in a bar near New Lanark. The image was covered by wallpaper some time ago, but was recently rediscovered when the owners of the bar restored the venue. Now aged 74, the original artist has returned to the venue to restore the mural, which is called The Falls of Clyde. Will falcons keep pigeons away from Parliament? A tender has been announced by the Scottish Parliament for falconers to bid on a contract worth £40,000, the aim being to scare off pigeons that have been causing disturbances at the building since its completion. Similar contracts already exist in public places such as Hampden Park and Westminster. ID card, bad news for Scottish wool. Plans to introduce ID cards for people entering the UK from outside the European Union will affect the wool industry within Scotland, according to the Wool Marketing Board. A decline in sheep shearers throughout the UK has meant that in recent years farms have relied on migrant workers from Australia and New Zealand during the summer months. The cost of the ID card, together with difficult application processes, has been claimed to put the shearers off. Edinburgh Lottery winner in no hurry to collect. Edinburgh's lottery players are being urged to check their tickets following the announcement that there is an unclaimed prize within the area of nearly £3 million. The ticket holder has until the 24th of September to make their claim, otherwise the money will be donated to the lottery's own Good Causes Fund. Highland filming for Bollywood thriller. Purple Lake, a Bollywood thriller, has been partly filmed in Urquhart Castle and around Inverness. The director claimed he had come to Scotland for the atmospheric landscape and skies. This comes shortly after the Oscar success of Slumdog Millionaire, which made reference to King Ussie, and is a further reflection of the UK being the largest audience after India itself for Bollywood films. Curtains for The Young Pretender. A curtain from Culloden House, where Bonnie Prince Charlie was based for a time to gather his forces, has been returned to the house after being presented by the group known as A Circle of Gentlemen. They're a group based on a secret society that supported the Jacobite cause long after their defeat at Culloden. Evidence found of cancer breaks. Scientists from the University of Edinburgh believe a body donated for medical science could hold the key to a cure for cancer. They say that a range of genetic differences between this body and normal human bodies effectively slows the impact of the disease if replicated. The circumstances of the death and identity of the body in question are being kept strictly secret. Don't forget to vote for next week's podcast subject at the website, which is someotherscotland.blogspot.com, and you can send any feedback about the podcast directly to me at mickbourdais@gmail.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Links for all of those are on the website.
You know what that is? That's a guy trying to talk with a mouth full of broken teeth. Broken teeth and a pretty disgusting amount of blood. He's trying to convince you not to buy a copy of Jack Wakes Up by Seth Harwood on May 5th. And he's doing this because he's a minor character from the book. Let's just say chapter 33 didn't turn out so good for him. But you see, hey, what's your name anyway? Never mind. I'm just going to call you Cossack. But you see, Cossack here, he's not the exception to the rule. Because people get busted the f*** up in this book. It's not a book about fluffy bunnies. It's a book about crime. About the seedy and dangerous side. About a guy who used to be a movie star. An action hero. About how he finds out he might just like the real action better. He's Jack Palms. Jesus. Is there a dentist in the house? Listen to Jack Wakes Up right now at SethHarwood.com. And on May 5th, go out and buy it. Because if you think Seth laid the beat down on the poor Ruski here, wait until you see what he does to the traditional publishing model. Seriously, Seth is good. Number one New York Times bestseller Michael Connelly said, Jack Wakes Up rocks. It's a fast, smooth ride on a highway not found on any map. Publishers Weekly added, readers who like their hard-boiled crime fiction violent and gritty will cheer Harwood's debut. So you don't have to take my word for it. But Seth is your boy. Go buy Jack Wakes Up now at sethharwood.com/preorder and help pave the way for all the rest of us who are podcasting novels.
Some Other Scotland by Mick Bourdais. Episode 16. For almost 2 months now, Erica had been living a double life, splitting her time between the dig back on the surface at Scarabray and the strange form of reverse archaeology being undertaken below ground in the Try. Tanya had guided her to the upper level of the underground village, past its number of anonymous-looking doors, to the tunnel at the top that led to the Neolithic remains above. It was a similar layout to the tunnel they had entered from below, with the same glowing illumination that followed them as they walked towards the surface, the same massive stone door preventing access without the device, the key, Erica presumed. At the end of the tunnel, a gap stood where once the stone pillar lift had sat, like a missing molar from a mouthful of perfect teeth. The first stage had been completed for her by Tanya's people, but there was still a lot of work to do. Over the course of those first 2 weeks, Erica had made sure her team on the surface were working on clearing around the part of the tunnel closest to House 7, checking that they avoided damaging the stonework of the existing excavation, and despite their occasional protest that they could be following the tunnel further out, keeping them focused on the entrance. As they were doing that, every evening she returned to the Try with Tanya to prepare the space below. She drew plans for the layout of a sacrificial altar, Tanya assisting her by searching for research papers and photographs online, as well as searching the archive of the Try for patterns and inscriptions their ancestors would have used thousands of years earlier. The room would reach as far down as the water's edge, just beyond the extent of the latest excavation. A long underground room of this nature would be unusual, though not unprecedented, adding to the mystery of Scarabray for generations to come. Every night, Erica left her instructions with the small group Tanya had gathered to assist in the tunnel's makeover, and returned to her caravan in time to catch a mere 4 hours' sleep before the whole cycle repeated. The former tunnel transformed with every visit, from a smooth-walled, self-lit access route into a place that appeared to speak of a deep religious significance from a time long gone. Ideally, she would have chosen to turn it into a burial chamber, but the room had to convince some of the most experienced archaeologists that it was authentic, which would be quite impossible to do without a body to support that lie. So instead it had become a room of prayer and sacrifice, decorated with delicately carved stone bowls and plinths, designed to be more intricate and detailed than those in the rest of the village above, in order to justify the existence of this hidden room. The surface of the walls had been gouged out by the group's impressive array of stoneworking tools, simple-looking black cylinders that sliced through stone with a remarkable ease, using a technology that Erica couldn't begin to comprehend, despite Tanya's willingness to explain it. The walls now looked identical to the stonework in the rest of the village above ground. After another few weeks, the walls had been plastered and decorated with murals and symbols consistent with the rest of Scarabray, and then aged artificially, according to Erica's own knowledge of Egyptian tombs sealed from the atmosphere. A fine layer of dust was spread all round, and the newly created room sealed off from the tunnel behind it. Once that was done, Erica had no need to continue her nightly trips to the Try, but continued them nonetheless, determined to see the whole project through to its conclusion. In particular, she wanted to ensure that the backfilling of the tunnel was done with suitable materials, though she hadn't expected to see the cutting devices used to melt large chunks of bedrock together, giving the impression that there was nowhere else to dig beyond the end of the room. After the solid rock, the underground workers brought in a set of ridge stone sheets, bearing the layout that Spike had pointed out to Erica weeks before, that would serve to refract any magnetic, sonar, or radar analysis attempted on the walls of the new room. The work was finally complete, when over 30 metres of solid rock stood between the fake religious chamber and the access to the Try. Erica spoke to Tanya as they watched the lights on the abandoned tunnel fade out for the last time.
I suppose that's us then. Back to reality for me and what for you?
Will you stay here? She asked. Oh no, my place is out there. I have much to do in the world, not least of all helping you open up a new exciting find at Scarabray. Cataloguing all that we discover there and putting your report out there to convince the world that another piece of the puzzle has been found. They'll never know that the piece in question happens to belong to a completely different jigsaw, of course, but you do know you'll be catapulted into the limelight, don't you? This will be seen as the most important find since Carter found Tutankhamun's tomb, said Tanya. Oh, I guess so. Life is going to get hectic pretty quickly, Eric answered. Razor spent the weeks since the tragedy in New York living rough. The police had traced Kyle's body and linked him to Razor with CCTV images of the pair at the parade, so he was keeping out of sight. With Kyle's killers left as dust, the murder could only be blamed on him, he was certain. His experience of some members of the police force in Glasgow and their treatment of suspects had left him with an inherent distrust of the law and those employed to uphold it. He'd also seen enough US cop shows on television to know that every precinct would have its share of bad eggs, and no desire to wind up at the muzzle end of a bent copper's gun. Major transport links would be no-go areas for the foreseeable future, so he was either trapped in New York or would have to find an alternative means of getting out of the city. For the first time in his life, Razor was glad of the shadier bits of his past. The months after leaving school, when he'd ended up living on the streets, building a drug habit that would certainly have killed him had it not claimed his two best friends within a week of each other first, finally bringing him to his senses and encouraging that first step to rehabilitation. Much of that time is a blur in his memory, but he had learnt how to survive in a harsh environment where life meant very little. Violence and robbery was a daily occurrence, and few could see a world beyond their next fix. The detached attitude required, the network of contacts who would sell anything to anyone, and the ability to defend himself were all key factors in his pulling through those bleak days, and the lessons he learnt on the streets of Glasgow would serve him well now. A section of the underbelly of the city was beginning to open up to him by the start of his third week in New York. As he learnt which people and places to avoid, where to find a semi-decent meal and a dry place to sleep. Now, he was on his way to meet Uncle Ronnie, a loan shark operating out of the South Bronx, in an effort to finance some means of transport, as his money had run out in the first week of his visit to the States. The back street he arrived at, behind a row of derelict shops, was to have been their meeting place that afternoon, but nobody appeared. Razor stood in the doorway with the blue door as he'd been instructed, but Uncle Ronnie didn't come. Razor, of course, had seen this sort of scam before, but believed the old woman who arranged the meeting had been genuine. With a deep feeling of unease, he left the doorway after a short wait, looking all around him for the gang that he fully expected to appear and attempt to take what little he currently had to his name. In his pocket, his fingers sought out this cool stone of the device, his only form of defence that he could rely on, as he took care, stepping towards the end of the street. There was a pile of clothing lying across the pavement he had to step over as he left, but as he looked down to do so, he found himself stepping over a body. Uncle Ronnie's body, he presumed. He bent over for a closer look. Yes, the dead face matched the description he'd been given by the old woman. Apart from the mask of agony it wore, that was a lasting detail provided by his assailant, Razor guessed.
Oh, that'll be the one standing behind you, you numpty, he thought to himself,
in the moment before the owner of the shadow that had just appeared knocked him out, cold. As they walked back through the Tri towards the lower tunnel for Tanya to return Erica to Scarabray, they were aware that something unusual was going on. A large group had gathered on the archive level, watching the screens that displayed news reports from various sources. The two women changed course and went to investigate.
"What's happening, Arthur?"
Tanya asked a middle-aged man at the edge of the crowd. Erica had been introduced to him on a previous visit, one of the senior archivists. He had responsibility for data stored within the system, tagging it as it flowed in to allow future recall to be as rapid as possible, reviewing the work of junior archivists, and escalating issues of concern to the Tri-Council.
"Another attack, Tanya," he said. "On the Merc this time. They didn't get in, but they've exposed the surface of the egg."
"How on earth? That's one of the deepest outstations we have, isn't it?"
Tanya queried.
"Yes, it was laid whilst the Glasgow subway was being excavated, so we took advantage of the depth and sunk it below the underground tunnels. It was an ideal way to place an outstation in the centre of what was, at the time, one of the world's largest and busiest cities. We normally have to locate them outside urban areas to avoid detection, but maybe we should have done the same for the Merc,"
said Arthur.
"Any direct links to last week's attacks?"
"No, not that we can see from these reports, but they're too close to be coincidences."
"Sorry, last week's attack?"
Erica butted in.
"You mean in New York? Was that something to do with you?"
"Yeah, we're waiting for the report to come back from our contact there, but by the nature of the damage done to the building, I would say that it doesn't look like a coincidence. Seems like it was sliced through by a rock cutter at full power. And I have checked with all our outstationed personnel. None of them are missing, so it must be an old one."
Tanya's shoulders dropped. She rubbed her eyes with her hands and sighed.
"It's started, hasn't it?"
she said to Arthur.
"I fear it may have. Your efforts with the tunnel above may have been unnecessary if things carry on like this, certainly."
"Okay, thanks, Arthur. We better get going, but call me if there's anything we can do to help," said Tanya.
As they left Arthur behind, Erica gave Tanya a look that she recognised instantly. It was the same look she had on her face when Tanya appeared from the tunnel under House 7.
"Yes, I know," she said. "What the hell is going on?"
"You could say that,"
Erica replied.
"You've seen a lot in the past few weeks, Erica. I know you appreciate how much of our technology the outside world would love to get its hands on. We're very careful as to how we conduct our business on the surface, but despite that, it has become apparent that a small number of people are aware of us. They may know only a small piece or two of information, but sometimes that is all that's required to pique a person's interest and set them off on a road of obsession, trying to prove themselves right."
"And you think that's what's happening here? Somebody's worked it out and is trying to break in?"
"Oh, I truly hope it is as simple as that. We are more concerned that this is a concerted effort by an organised group. Possibly military or big business. The sort of groups who have a seriously large amount of money to invest in something that could potentially put them ahead of their competition, whether that's another company or another country."
Erica nodded, considering the consequences of such a situation.
"It's happened before, though to a lesser extent. About 80 years ago, some detective working on a case in London came across two pictures of one of us taken 70 years apart, with no sign of ageing. He thought this was proof of the fountain of youth, and spent years gathering enough rich old men who wanted to live forever to invest in him. Formed a private army and followed her wherever she went. They tried to break into her outstation and it ended badly. Dozens of them were killed by the reflective blast of the bomb they set off. This time, if they have one of our rock-cutting tools, they're more dangerous, whoever they are."
"Yes, I can see that.
What was that egg that Arthur was talking about?"
"Ah, that's just the name we give to the little pods we use to set up outstations, like the Merc. They're little living spaces that can be dropped off from our ships and buried out of sight. They're more or less self-sufficient, extracting energy from the ground they're buried in. Our people on the outside often extend them, though, with their cutting devices, to enhance the living space, but the basic shell is the same. They have links to the archive and a local system if they become cut off for any reason."
"And nobody's ever found one?"
"No, not yet. They're genetically linked to the inhabitant, you see. When they die, the egg seals itself completely and degrades. It takes about 6 months, but everything within it turns to solid rock,
with no evidence of any form of life or technology inside whatsoever. There is simply nothing for the archaeologist to find. This place is the same. When the last of us dies off, it will degrade into the surrounding rock. Every new birth is registered in the archive, so as long as we keep reproducing, it will keep running.
That's a pretty clever idea. So, do you have a miracle cure for aging?
No, there's no cure as such, but we did some dabbling in genetic engineering many years ago. Thousands, in fact. It was stopped after a while because side effects and unwanted mutations were becoming more common. But in that time, our inherited gene structure was altered to improve us physically, including better resilience to disease. And our medicines also helped towards that end. Things like strokes, cancer, heart attacks, dementia, unheard of. Almost 98% of our deaths are due to old age, the body just giving up. At around the 200-year mark.
200? My God, that's amazing! So, how old am I?
Have a guess,
said Tanya.
Well, you look in your early 30s, so maybe 50?
78.
Jeez Louise, that's amazing.
Well, some live to 250, but they tend to be the dedicated scientists who want to see their life's work completed. Most have seen and done everything they want from life, and are tired by the time they reach 200. It's almost a matter of choice by that time.
Well, I can see why the world outside would want in on that, and the benefits of breaking into an egg, but why attack the Empire State Building?
Well, that is a good question, and one that I want to find an answer to.
So, let's get back to the camp and sleep on it.
If you're listening to this podcast at Podiobooks, please do take time to visit our main website at someotherscotland.blogspot.com, where you can vote in weekly polls that will change the plot of the story. You can download spin-off episodes and other special chat episodes for more background about the series. The music from this podcast is from the track No Strings Attached by The Lunacy Board, who can be found at www.lunacyboard.com. The podcast is produced under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license, which means, in a nutshell, that you can copy it ad infinitum, email it to your friends, stick it on your webpage or your MP3 player or iPod, anything you like. Just so long as you don't change it in any way, you don't make money from it, and you let people know where it has come from originally. someotherscotland.blogspot.com